From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, the story of the Wisconsin DOT's effort to convert U.S. Highway 41 to an interstate. Later, one scientist says we shouldn't worry too much about Asian carp getting to Lake Michigan. They'd starve.
There's virtually no phytoplankton in Lake Michigan left to sustain the Asian carp.
Plus, the contradictions of higher education during the Cold War. And Milwaukee Magazine's Tim McCormick says there's no need to be bummed by the end of the summer art season.
There's no doubt if you follow even 4 or 5 of our recommendations here, you will not have that crestfallen feeling.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Anyone who's driven U.S. Highway 41 north of Milwaukee knows that for all intents and purposes, it's a superhighway. It carries thousands of cars and heavy trucks every day to places such as Oshkosh, Appleton, and Green Bay. But if a plan under consideration by the Wisconsin Department of Transportation moves forward, U.S. 41 will become Interstate 41 as soon as next year. Tammy Raby is the planning project manager for the DOT, and she joins us on the line from Green Bay to fill in some of the details. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
What's the impetus for this change?
Well, back in 2005, Congressman Petri enacted legislation that had Wisconsin Department of Transportation study the U.S. 41 corridor for inclusion into the interstate highway system. And he did that at the urging of local economic development representatives and chambers of commerce who felt that U.S. 41 was not getting the national recognition that it deserves as being a high-speed, high-quality freeway, and that interstate designation would allow for more economic growth in the Fox Valley area.
As those of us who live in Wisconsin know, a large stretch of U.S. 41 through that area is a high-speed, high-capacity kind of highway. Is it just the image that the U.S. 41 brings that is the key issue that people that wanted this change were working against?
Exactly. I feel that what we've heard from the economic development folks from across the area is that having that interstate shield, the blue and red shield, will allow the areas to market to nationally recognized companies. And people do recognize that an interstate highway has a certain quality that a U.S. highway may not have. There are U.S. highways throughout Wisconsin and our nation that are just two-lane highways, and they go through urban areas. And what U.S. 41 currently is looks just like an interstate. And people around Wisconsin are aware of that, but people outside of Wisconsin don't realize what type of highway facility it is.
Well, and I wonder if you can help us a little bit with some maybe historical perspective on this. U.S. highways like U.S. 41 predated the interstate highway system frequently. How are those highways typically funded and maintained today compared with interstates?
Well, that's really up to each state. Each state gets federal highway funding through a process where it's calculated how much each state is going to get. And then we work as a department with Federal Highway Administration to fund our projects. And the way Wisconsin does it is we work with a 6-year program determining what projects have the highest priority, and then we apply our federal dollars as well as state dollars and potentially local dollars to the project. So I can't really speak for how other states, you know, handle that, but we do use a 6-year program and we prioritize. And of course, an interstate highway is likely to get a higher priority. However, U.S. 41 is already a priority corridor for our state. So I'm not sure that this really is going to make a difference in the amount of funding or work that you'll actually see along this corridor.
Where is the process at this point?
Well, we've been studying the conversion of U.S. 41 to an interstate for several years, and we have a draft environmental document that we have signed by the Federal Highway Administration, and we're planning to take that to the public for comment at our public hearings. And once we get the public comments and we get that environmental document finalized, then we will work with Federal Highway Administration to get the final paperwork and the final package signed so that it can become an interstate. And there are also a couple other things that need to happen prior to this getting signed as well. You may have heard news about federal legislation that will allow for the current trucks that are using US 41 to continue using 41 after it becomes an interstate. The state of Wisconsin allows trucks to haul over 80,000 pounds along US 41. They have more axles added or they have some different loading. And Wisconsin decided that this was in the best interest of our state, and our highway is designed to handle these trucks and handle that commerce. But federal legislation is needed to allow that once it becomes an interstate highway. And Congressman Petri was able to, and Congressman Ribble as well, were able to get that legislation passed through the House back in July. And it was introduced into the Senate but referred to committee. And now the Senate is on recess. So the thought is that once the Senate is back in session, that they should take up that legislation and pass that legislation that will allow the trucks to continue hauling on 41 as they're currently hauling today after interstate conversion.
The issue is that typically interstate highways do not allow trucks of that size and weight to travel?
Yes, exactly. It's a federal law that interstate highways have a maximum gross vehicle weight of 80,000 pounds. Now, there's plenty of places where these grandfathering legislation has been in effect, and similarly, we did get that legislation in the mid-90s when US 51 was converted to I-39. So it's not something new or something unusual, but in order to allow these agricultural products and timber products and those type of products to continue hauling from field to market, we need to have that federal legislation enacted.
Now, I know the environmental impact statement isn't finalized yet, but what are the physical kinds of things that have to happen to the highways to allow them to come up to interstate specs?
Well, really, US 41 does meet the interstate specifications for the most part. There are some areas where shoulders will be widened in upcoming resurfacing projects, and different type of improvements will be made as maintenance projects happen along the corridor. You will see things like median cable guard or improved side slopes and widened shoulders. But that would likely have happened regardless of interstate conversion because, like I said, US 41 is considered a high-quality freeway. We have the speed limits of 65 miles an hour, and because of all the traffic that's currently using them, it is considered one of our priority corridors. So those improvements would have been made likely regardless of interstate conversion.
Aside from the red and blue shields that would go up, are there signage changes that would have to happen? And beyond that, other features that we're used to seeing as part of interstates, things like rest areas?
We will not be adding any new rest areas as part of our interstate conversion project. The biggest change that you will see is the blue and red shields going up from the Wisconsin state line up to Green Bay. And we do not need to change any of the mile markers or exit numbers as part of interstate conversion. We have worked with a committee to take a look at how this all affects the highway numbering and everything. And it was determined that we would leave the mile markers in place so you won't see any exit numbers changing. The one other significant change that will happen is that US 41 will be rerouted to follow our Interstate 41 corridor. So right now, when you get to Milwaukee at the Mitchell Interchange, US 41 follows 94 up through the Marquette Interchange and to the Stadium Interchange, and then it follows Lisbon Avenue and Appleton Avenue up to where it meets Highway 45. So US 41 actually does go on some city streets in Milwaukee. US 41 will be rerouted to follow 894 and 45 around Milwaukee. And that section of US 41 that is on Appleton Avenue and Lisbon Avenue will be renamed Wisconsin 175, which is a continuation of Wisconsin 175, where it extends to the northwest from Appleton Avenue.
And is that going to hold true for the short stretch that people know of as the stadium freeway from I-94 to North Avenue?
Yes, that stretch of the stadium freeway will be called Wisconsin 175 as well.
Is there a certain amount of, and I'm not sure whether this is the right term, but legacy naming that would exist? I mean, there are always people who are reluctant to change or slow to change or slow to realize change has happened. Are these highways going to be co-branded for a while?
Along the highway, you will see mostly Interstate 41 shields, but we will also have reassurance signing that will allow people, drivers, to realize that they're still on US 41 as well, because US 41 is a national corridor that runs from Florida all the way up to Michigan. So you will be on US 41 and I-41. But we feel that because both numbers are 41, that will actually cause less driver confusion because people will realize that, okay, we're on US 41 and I-41.
But I imagine there are any number of businesses along the way or you know, things like restaurants and motels that have brochures that reference US 41 that might not change right away.
Exactly. This does allow them to have time to make those changes. We have been working with the local area chambers of commerce and economic development corporations, so they realize this is happening. And actually, some businesses have already started making the change in advance. So we have noticed that there's been some signs that say that businesses are along I-41, even though it's not I-41 yet. So I think that a lot of the business owners are excited about this change.
Well, and barring any setbacks, what is the soonest that we're likely to start seeing the I-41 shields go up along the highway?
Right now, my project team is working to have a bid letting for contractors in March of 2014. And so we need that federal grandfathering legislation to happen and our agreement, everything to move forward with the Federal Highway Administration. But if all goes well, the signing projects will be let in March of 2014, and you will see interstate shields going up in the summer and fall of 2014.
Well, perhaps we'll check in with you as that date comes closer. Tammy Raby, thanks so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tammy Raby is the planning project manager for the Wisconsin Department of Transportation's Interstate 41 project. She joined us on the line from Green Bay. There is more information about the project and the upcoming public hearings on it from WUWM.com/lakeeffect. Keep listening. We'll take a break now, and in a moment, we'll update the status of Asian carp and Lake Michigan. That's when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Last month, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers announced a $2.8 million contract to construct a new electric barrier in the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal. It's the latest in the Corps' efforts to hold back the Asian carp from entering the Great Lakes. Although recent samples collected from the Kalamazoo River in Michigan found no evidence of Asian carp there, its DNA has previously been detected in Chicago-area waterways as close as 7 miles from Lake Michigan. Scientist John Jansen has spent much of his career studying invasive species, in particular the round goby. The UWM School of Freshwater Sciences researcher shared his big-picture view of the state and future of the Great Lakes, in particular Lake Michigan, out in the field with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. Jansen doesn't believe Asian carp poses a threat to Lake Michigan. Number one, he says Lake Michigan does not have the food source Asian carp depend on.
The Asian carp feed on the little suspended algae called phytoplankton. And there's a lot of phytoplankton in a big fertile river like the Mississippi and the Illinois, etc. And they filter that phytoplankton out as their food. In Lake Michigan, the animal that's doing that same thing and much more effectively is the quagga mussel, which is what replaced the more familiar to the general public zebra mussel. And quagga mussels basically are so efficient that they starve the zebra mussels out. So there's virtually no phytoplankton in Lake Michigan left to sustain the Asian carp. Green Bay, southern Green Bay, might have enough, but there doesn't seem to be an area for them to spawn in southern Green Bay. They seem to need about 60 miles of river for their drifting eggs to hatch. The location where they're likely to be a problem would be western Lake Erie, which is very fertile to the point of being problematical. It's fertile because a lot of nutrients go in via the Maumee River, which enters at Toledo, which is south of Detroit. So there's plenty of food in Lake Erie, and the Maumee River is very likely a very good place for them to spawn. That means that Asian carp are an issue for at least sectors of the Great Lakes, but not likely Lake Michigan. There's almost nobody who actually works in the open lake that thinks that the Asian carp can survive there, can find the food there, and they're probably not going to like the big violent waves either.
Let's say, in theory, some carp made their way into Lake Michigan and they found our rivers. First of all, is that possible? And secondly, if that happened, could that be an issue?
Possibly a local issue. I mean, it's not an open water Lake Michigan issue. Yeah. Are there rivers where they might spawn and it might be fertile enough? Most likely on the Michigan side, maybe the Muskegon River. We're likely to get strays coming through the canal system. And actually, for a while, we were getting stray skipjack herring.
And what's the story with the skipjack?
Skipjack, interesting fish. Superficially, they look like an alewife. They look like a giant alewife. They're going to be a foot long. And they're natives of the Mississippi River. And some of those were straying through the canal systems around Chicago into Lake Michigan. And it was something that we would regularly catch in our nets, but it never became abundant because it's a river fish. It's a big river fish, but very similar to the alewife. So I sort of suspect, yeah, we'll see some stray Asian carp getting into Lake Michigan, but it'll be like the skipjack herring, sort of a curiosity, etc. But that also makes the point that the issue is really the canal system around Chicago, because that's a conduit for invasive species to go from the Great Lakes down to the Mississippi, which of course already happened with zebra mussels and quagga mussels and round gobies, etc. And it is a conduit potentially for things that are a problem that become invasive initially in the Mississippi drainage to move into the Great Lakes. That is the serious issue. You always have the possibility that you're wrong about the Asian carp, etc., but the canal's the issue.
Is there a consensus among scientists, Great Lakes scientists, that those basins need to be permanently severed?
I would say there's a consensus among the scientists for that. But you have to think there are other consequences. So Chicago basically sends its sewage waste down to the Mississippi River, and that's been going on for, you know, a bit over a century now. And they started doing that to control disease, because when you think of the size of that city, all that sewage going to Lake Michigan, well, I don't know, maybe it'll make it fertile enough for the Asian carp. Okay, so Chicago doesn't fully treat its sewage, basically the canal system, part of the canal system, because there's a shipping canal and there's a sanitary canal. I mean, it's part of the sewage processing system in a sense, but it is sort of an open sewer, and you can smell that. They have aerators on it to keep the water aerated so it doesn't get really stinky. But if you're going to close down the canals, then you have to think about where all that Chicago sewage is going to go. You're going to have to clean it up, and the water's going to go in, well, most likely Lake Michigan. At least that'd be the least expensive thing. And Chicago's huge. That's a huge issue. So, and that's an engineering, sanitary engineering. You need the expertise from somebody of that to say how much that would cost and the other sorts of effects. But you can say this for sure. Lake Michigan is actually pretty pristine. You always have problems around harbors, which is where people live, and so they notice those sorts of things. But my gosh, you get out in the open water and the water's blue. not as blue as the ocean, but it's pretty blue, and you're thinking, wow, this is really amazingly clean water. Anytime you see fresh water that's blue, you're saying that is really the clean water. And actually, part of that cleanliness is because of the quagga mussels.
Well,
it's
that's
a
what
positive
I was thinking
thing.
About.
Right, it
yeah.
is. It was, yeah.
So, talking big picture, and when you do consider the number of invasives that have gone after the Great Lakes, can we go back in any way to natives that were there decades ago? Or were you just looking at a different lake that you try to keep as balanced as possible?
Almost certainly looking at a different lake. So, but we ran into basically this problem in the mid-1960s. And the people who worked on it now are older, gone. But
That wasn't the lamprey. We're not talking.
No,
lamprey.
We're talking about it's a consequence of the lamprey. See, when you get an invasion, it takes a while for things to sort of restabilize, and we're still restabilizing from the quagga mussels. The quagga mussels was the changeover from zebra mussels. Okay, so the zebra mussels show up in numbers in the summer of 1991. And the whole lake changes. It becomes transparent. The water gets a little blue. Scuba diving, we would see on a good day, you could see your dive partner maybe 10 feet away, and that was rare. It was usually half that. And all of a sudden, in one summer, you could see your dive partner 30 feet away. And you're feeling like, wow, this is a little bit more like a coral reef. And now it's not unusual to have maybe 60 feet of visibility because the quagga mussels have cleaned it up even more. And that turbidity was the phytoplankton. That was the food that would go to certain fishes ultimately. So that's a huge change. But the change prior to that was dramatic was, call it the sequence of the lamprey losing the top predators, lake trout and burbot, and an invasive gets a toehold, and the invasive is the alewife. And it's fun to look at Time magazine in 1967, because there's a summer issue where there's an article about the destruction of the recreational industry on Lake Michigan because of the massive alewife die-off. You could smell them well inland, and nobody was going to go to the beach, and this recreational industry was declared dead because the alewives would be there to die off forever and ever. We had an alewife die-off this spring, rather unusual. But the next year in Time magazine, 1968, there was an article, so this is like 14 months later, about the spectacular recreational industry on Lake Michigan because Michigan DNR had taken a very aggressive approach, sort of a cowboy approach, but they put the salmon in Lake Michigan. And they will say, the people that instigated that will say, we didn't do that to control the alewives. We did it to create a sport fishery to make use of the alewives. I think we're in basically the same kind of situation now. What they did, and I say it's cowboy in the sense that Michigan did it unilaterally. They said, we are doing this, and they could at the time. But they researched it extensively. It was state-of-the-art fisheries science for the time. If you read the material that they wrote, it is... They made use of all the information that they could get a hold of and made the judgment that they would put salmon in Lake Michigan. And, of course, they've been in the other Great Lakes since. But I think we're in a similar kind of situation right now. The lake has changed. The phytoplankton aren't there to support the zooplankton that supported the alewife. The salmon are not growing nearly so much as they have. The stocking of them has been decreased, in part because of the food and in part because they're naturally reproducing. The salmon are I think, here to stay, and that's probably a good thing, but it's not going to be the situation, certainly not the situation of 1968, where the salmon were huge, or the 70s or the 80s. It's going to be different. But I think it's time to rethink the ecosystem all the way, and think of it as an ecosystem approach. So an interesting thing is, so you manufacture history, and the thought is that putting salmon in the lake was ecosystem management. Get rid of the nuisance alewife, and a lot of people think that. But that's not what the fisheries scientists were thinking. They were thinking, no, we can make this amazing new salmon fishery. And it turned out to be ecosystem management because the alewives weren't messing up the beaches so much.
So do you have a vision of the bold moves that would be appropriate now for Lake Michigan?
I've got ideas. Other people have ideas. The discussions are going on. It should be in a public sort of forum. I mean, the people that are having the good ideas are generally pretty smart. I mean, like, you don't find a good fisherman that isn't a good naturalist. They study a lot, and we learn a lot from them because there's more of them than us. They'll say, here's an odd fish. Is this invasive? And like with the round goby, a lot of places, maybe most places where we found round gobies first, it was a fisherman that said, is this a round goby? So they're smart and they're paying attention, and we need to make use of that.
John Jansen is a researcher and professor with UWM's School of Freshwater Sciences. His specialties are fisheries ecology and biological oceanography. He spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. How places like the University of Wisconsin-Madison found themselves torn by the Cold War. A new book examines that issue, and we'll learn about it when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. In the 1950s and 60s, as the Cold War heated up, if you will, universities like UW-Madison found themselves in an awkward situation. The schools were hotbeds for protest of federal policies linked to the Cold War, even as the federal government was increasingly funding programs at those schools to benefit Cold War policy. That interesting dichotomy is chronicled by Wisconsin writer Matthew Levin in his book Cold War University, Madison and the New Left in the 1960s. Levin spoke with Lake Effect's Rachel Bloom and explained the phrase Cold War University.
Well, it's a term that I kind of borrowed. And what defines it is kind of this development in higher education after World War II, early years of the Cold War, where the federal government kind of steps in ways that it hadn't done before. And it really changed the way that higher education was funded, changed some of the purposes of higher education so that the University of Wisconsin, along with many other universities, large universities in particular, were involved in ways they had never been before in the nation's defense and particularly in the Cold War struggle. And you kind of see it a lot of different ways. You see it especially in funding for research programs, some of the military related, but not all of them. And you also see it in scholarship programs, the National Defense Education Act, which comes along in the late 50s. So it's not, you know, something you can kind of put your finger on and say, aha, this was the moment when this started, or this is the crux of this. It's something that happened over time after World War II and kind of happened a little haphazardly. But by the time you get to 1960, you can really see that the university has shifted its footing somewhat from before.
But the Cold War University is also partly composed by a changing student population as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It is affected by a new generation of students. You, of course, get the returning veterans after World War II. And then later on, you get the baby boom generation. You definitely get students that are influenced in ways by the culture around them that, you know, didn't exist prior to the Cold War. So you get students that are growing up in a time of constant threat that had not existed in the past. today we've adjusted somewhat to the presence of nuclear weapons in the world. But in the late 40s and early 50s, that was a real presence in students' minds. And so a lot of students did come of age in the 1950s and 1960s not sure about the world that they were inheriting, not comfortable with it, alienated in some ways from their parents and from the policies of their government.
I want you to tell us a little bit about what you call the contradictions of Cold War era higher education.
Yeah, this is kind of a crucial idea in the research that I did and the writings that I've done on the topic. The idea is, you know, on the one hand, the University of Wisconsin and many other universities kind of get pulled into this Cold War development in the 1950s, especially in the 1960s. So you can definitely see that. You can see it in the expansion of universities. You can see it in the change in research that takes place, emphasis on sciences in particular. In Madison, at the University of Wisconsin, you can see it in the creation, for example, of the Army Math Research Center, which is a big deal in the mid-50s and is kind of celebrated as a way of, you know, the university aiding the nation's defense and working with the Army in a cooperative way. And that was non-controversial when it opened in the mid-1950s. But in addition to that kind of direction, you get this paradoxical direction that comes as well. Along with the increasing student body, you get more and more students who are more likely to question what they're seeing around them, who are growing up during the Cold War, coming of age during this time, looking at the changes in the university, not always in positive ways. So even as the Cold War is expanding universities and changing its direction in some ways, it's feeding this emergence of dissent. So you kind of get these two situations that are running parallel to each other, but in very different ways, if that makes any sense.
You keep referencing Madison as one of many Cold War universities. So what is it about Madison that makes it in particular worth studying? Why not another Cold War university like Berkeley or Michigan?
That's a good question. And there's no doubt that there's plenty of reason to look into other Cold War universities. Berkeley and Michigan would be at the top of the list. Someone else wrote a book about Stanford and the creation of the Cold War University. There are plenty of other places to look as well. And part of the argument that I make in my research and writing is about the kind of national changes that are taking place. And Madison is just one place to see those changes, like kind of on a micro level, so you can kind of see them taking place. But there is something going on in Madison that's a little different. You see that come out in the kind of intellectual community that I write about, and that's this emergence of not only undergraduate students and graduate students, but also professors who are engaged in kind of an intellectual project to rethink American policies, especially foreign policy, to consider what a new direction on the left might look like. And then once this new direction on the left has taken hold, and they actually call it the new left, once that's taken hold, to start thinking about, well, where is this going? What are we trying to accomplish? How do we get there? And there's a real tension in the 1960s between activism, the popular images that we think of when we consider the 1960s, the protests, the rallies, the demonstrations, those kinds of things. There's a tension, and you really see it in Madison more than in some other places, I think, between the activism, which is common everywhere, and yet in Madison you also find this kind of intellectual direction. There are still people in Madison, even at the height of the protests, at the height of the rallies, at the height of the violence in the late 60s and early 70s, where folks are still talking about how do we make this movement into something lasting, into something permanent, into something that's going to really transform America.
I thought it was interesting that you mentioned Madison as a university that's as old as the state itself. So mm-hmm. there is also this special connection between the university and the state government, at least, even before the new left emerged.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So who were these people in the new left? What did the new left represent?
Well, there's a long strain in American politics, and people are familiar with the terms left and right, conservative and liberal, sometimes maybe radical or reactionary. These are all terms that are used to describe different political currents that exist throughout our history. The new left was kind of a movement that emerged in the late 50s, early 1960s that really tried to find a new direction for the left. Previous to this, the left in American politics had mostly been the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, and there had been some electoral victories. In Milwaukee, for example, you have some prominent socialists who run for mayor and serve as mayor. You have socialists serving in the U.S. House of Representatives representing the Milwaukee area. So there is this older left strain in American politics. But in the 1950s and 1960s, you get a group of young people in particular who are not too enamored with this older strain and who are trying to find a new direction, trying to rethink how to reshape America. And the real things that define the new left, for one, their kind of youthfulness defines them somewhat, their willingness to throw overboard what their parents and grandparents had done as socialists or communists, and also their emphasis on America's foreign policy and also issues of race that were brought on by the civil rights movement. So they are obviously interested in class issues like the left had been before them, but they kind of broaden the template somewhat and, of course, also incorporate activism in ways that the earlier left had not. And it was in reaction to the civil rights movement, in reaction to the Vietnam War, in reaction to the Cold War. So these new events pushed the left in new directions.
And also the creation of these Cold War universities and this federal funding into defense research spurred protest. The university's policy of allowing Dow Chemical to recruit on campus
right.
led to a series of protests in 1967, and it climaxed in a violent confrontation with the police. How did this event impact student protest movements in Madison?
Well, you can really see the impact of the Cold War when you start looking at the demonstrations. It's not just that every demonstration was against the Vietnam War. I mean, the Vietnam War was always there in the background once you get to 1965 or 1966. But the students don't just go out and demonstrate against the Vietnam War in an ambiguous sense. They really focus in on the university and its sponsorship, its participation in the Vietnam War and in the Cold War, and its close partnership with the federal government. And so the Dow demonstration is really focused on the university's willingness to allow large corporations that are engaged in Dow's case, making napalm for the war effort, the university's willingness to let these corporations and at other times groups like the CIA come onto campus and recruit students who are willing to work for them in the future. So you really get students reacting to the university's partnership in a way with large corporations and with the federal government. And that creates the real impetus for a lot of the demonstrations. Another example is in 1966, there was a large draft sit-in. And it was an anti-draft sit-in, but it was focused again on the university and its partnership with the selective service system in offering draft exams, in offering up student GPA information, all this kind of stuff. And the student protesters didn't want the university to participate in this. You know, they were opposed to the draft. They were opposed to the Vietnam War, but they kind of zeroed in on the examples of the university's relationship with the federal government and the Cold War. Later on, of course, in the most – perhaps the most famous event was the 1970 bombing of Sterling Hall, which housed the Army Math Research Center, which in the 1950s had been totally non-controversial. I couldn't find one peep of anybody thinking it was a bad idea. And by the late 60s, you know, the students are up in arms over the university's willingness to house an Army Math Research Center on its campus.
Do you feel that these protest movements were effective in causing change with the university and its relationship to the federal government?
That's a tough question, a good one. And I try and tackle it a little bit in the book, but there's no easy answer. The short answer as far as changing the university is no. The university didn't really shift all that much. In some ways, university administrators, the regents, the state government just simply outlasted the protest movement. And there were some changes. There was a teaching assistance union created. There was a Black Studies department created. Students got new roles in kind of governance of the university. So they were included on committees and things like that. So there certainly were some changes. But in a larger aspect, the university did not fundamentally change from the direction it had taken after World War II and beginning with the Cold War. In a larger sense, though, if you start to look past the university, you can start to see some of the real changes. And you can start to see them especially when you look at issues of race, when you look at issues of gender, when you look at movements that emerge out of this, like the gay rights movement and the environmental conservation movement. You really start to see a significant shift in the way people think, in American culture, in American social organization. It's dramatic, the changes that have taken place since the 1960s as a result of this. So on the one hand, the student protest movement was not successful in changing the university. On the other hand, it was immensely successful in changing American culture.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate your time.
Matthew Levin's book is called Cold War University, Madison and the New Left in the 1960s, published by the University of Wisconsin Press. Levin, who also teaches high school social studies in McFarland, Wisconsin, spoke with Rachel Bloom. One last break, and then we'll look forward to the fall arts season in Milwaukee that begins tonight. Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. As much as we might hate to admit it, the season we think of as summer is behind us, even if the weather and the calendar might officially disagree. But cushioning that blow is the beginning of a busy fall art season, which Milwaukee Magazine previews in its September cover story. Managing editor Tim McCormick is here with a preview of the preview. Welcome to Lake Effect.
I thank you so much for having me.
How would you contrast the feel of the fall art season with what we experience every year here during the summer?
Well, the summer, I think we've hit on it earlier. A lot of your listeners will be well aware. There's a lot of, obviously, outdoor music concerts. It seems to be dominated by the music scene. A lot of the more traditional fine arts programming kind of takes a little bit of a hiatus, gets geared up, takes a little bit of a respite, and gets ready for the fall, announcing their program, you know, well in advance, but still getting all their T's crossed and I's dotted, making sure that they're ready for that season.
Not that there's ever anything wrong with the fall arts scene, but it does tend to, you know, you get inside under indoor lights, and maybe we might feel a little crestfallen after spending 3 months outdoors.
Oh, I think that's wrong. I think there's just too much going on the stages in Milwaukee this fall. There's no doubt if you follow even 4 or 5 of our recommendations here, you will not have that crestfallen feeling.
Well, that is why we have you here. And so you have the guide divided up sensibly into categories like music and dance and theater and such. Before we get to some of the highlights from each, what would you say are the can't-miss events that transcend traditional boundaries? If you're into dance, you still would go to this. Or
right.
If you're into music, you would still go to this.
If you don't mind, I'd just like to go in order as we
sure.
have them in the magazine. And under the music, I was very intrigued to see Sarah Brightman come into town. A pretty well-known name, obviously invented the role. She's a Broadway legend. Her husband, Andrew Lloyd Webber, she's got bona fides from here to London and back. She is also training to be a cosmonaut these days. I don't know if many of our listeners...
I was not aware of that.
Yeah, yeah. Somewhat of a dream for her. She said she watched the moon landing when she was a kid and ever since then has been captivated by the dream of flying into space. She's currently doing her training, as I said, as a cosmonaut out in Russia, but should be launching off, I think, in 2014 here. But aside from that interesting backstory, she's just a phenomenal talent. I don't know that you'll find anybody better on the stages this fall when it comes to music.
So it's Sarah Brightman, and I forget whether you mentioned, but September 29th at the Riverside Theater.
The Riverside Theater, indeed. And then theater, the one that I'm very intrigued about, and I hope I don't just focus on the blurbs that I've written about, but this one specifically really caught my eye. It's called The Ghost Brothers of Darklin County, taking place October 29 at the Riverside Theater again. But you've got writer Stephen King combining forces with John Mellencamp and T-Bone Burnett to put on a stage performance. Obviously, a lot of music in there with John Mellencamp and T-Bone Burnett involved. But it's an odd story of love and lust and family bonds that kind of maybe took place near some land that Mellencamp owns in Indiana. But just anything T-Bone Burnett touches these days seems to be phenomenal stuff.
Well, and I would say you have already succeeded in your arts guide, because this is something that I was entirely not aware of.
Excellent.
And you have
Excellent.
Me sufficiently intrigued that I'm going to run out after this interview is done and learn more.
Excellent. Excellent. One more that we hope you run out to right away for is the Acts of Wilderness that's being staged by Wild Space Dance Company. Obviously a great name in town here. They've done a lot of tremendous work. But this one is taking place September 19 through 21. It's a site-specific work that's taking place at Three Bridges Park.
And this is the newest park in
Milwaukee.
Newest
park in Milwaukee, found on the banks of the Menominee Valley in between, I think it's the 35th Street Viaduct and the 27th Street Viaduct. So it's just always interesting to see how artists like this incorporate the space into their performance.
And that is the Acts of Wilderness at Three Bridges Park, September 19th through the 21st. So let's jump back to the music section for just a couple of minutes and talk about maybe we can tempt people across some of the subgenres of music, starting with an event that's actually happening tonight.
Right. Mumford & Sons, I think even if you don't know the name of the band, it's pretty hard to avoid their music these days. They'll be playing tonight at the Marcus Amphitheater, so it's just amazing. We will have Labor Day in our rearview mirror for just about a day, but we're not wasting any time. The fall programming begins anew. And again, for people like you that may be crestfallen once the lights go dim and you find yourself indoors, this one does take place at the Marcus Amphitheater, so you can squeeze out a little bit of summer, weather depending, before we get into fall.
Nice way to spend a September evening.
Indeed, indeed.
Well, maybe you're not into contemporary music, even though you could make the argument that Mumford & Sons kind of transcends decades. But let's talk about perhaps another group that has always kind of pushed the boundaries, and that's the Kronos Quartet.
Yes, indeed. It's amazing when you start to dig into their catalog. The array of artists that they have recorded with, performed with, as we mentioned in our article, they've shared studio space with Nine Inch Nails, Bjork, the Dave Matthews Band. So again, this is a group that has transcended their supposed classical boundaries to break into more pop music genre. The show coming October 11th to the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center for the Arts is a bit of a homecoming, because the violinist for the Kronos Quartet, John Sherba, is a Wisconsin native.
Which is another something I didn't know. And again, that's the Kronos Quartet. It's going on in Brookfield at the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center for the Arts, which if you live downtown is a bit of a drive, but it is a remarkable center.
Wonderful, and wonderful facility.
And certainly this will be worth the trip. And then maybe a little bit more tradition when we talk about the Florentine Opera. They are kicking off their season. It's their 80th season with an opera that many will know.
Indeed. I think you pronounce it a little bit better than I, so do you mind?
La Traviata.
Isn't that beautiful, listeners?
Oh, thank you.
That is wonderful. again, like you said, the 80th season, which kind of astounded me that the Florentine Opera will be kicking off here in Milwaukee.
They don't look a day over 79.
but again, that was part of the tough part here is a lot of these arts groups have so many wonderful performances that it was tough to figure out which one we wanted to highlight. This one, like we said, it's the premiere for their 80th season, a well-loved performance that a lot of the listeners will be familiar with.
That's November 8th and 10th at the Marcus Center. Well, let's move back to theater for a moment. You mentioned the Ghost Brothers of Darkland County, but what's another play that'll be on stage this fall that people ought to take a look at?
I think Groucho, A Life in Review, is something that would appeal to maybe some of the older Milwaukeeans out there. As Paul Kosadowski points out, actor Norman Moses, well-known here in the community, has many talents, including doing a mean Groucho Marx imitation. So again, like we're talking about, some of the non-traditional stuff that you might want to see, it can still grab you. You don't have to yawn as soon as you hear live theater.
Well, and interestingly, you know, for the younger listeners, they'll be fascinated to know that actually the iconic glasses,
exactly,
nose, and mustache once actually were associated with a particular
belong
person.
To a person, yes. Exactly. and then also for our even younger set, you might get excited. I hope my son isn't listening, because we haven't unveiled that we're going to take him to this yet. But they have both Sesame Street Live coming November 29 and through December 1 to the BMO Bradley Harris Center, and as well as Disney Live coming November 16th to the Milwaukee Theater. So again, all ages are covered here. We try to make sure we've got a little something for everybody.
All right. You mentioned Acts of Wilderness in the dance category. Are there other dance performances that people ought to take note of?
One, again, that I think might not be on everybody's radar, if only for geographic reasons. You might not have gone to the South Milwaukee Performing Arts Center. Again, a stunning venue. But we have Soul of Flamenco coming through. So that should be a hot show, which takes place in the middle of November, November 16th, in fact. But that might warm you up as we start to approach snowfall and all those great things that accompany winter.
Now the ever tricky category known as arts, which I thought we had been talking about all this time.
Exactly, exactly. Maybe a little more traditional, what you might see inside the Milwaukee Art Museum, the Wisconsin Museum of Art. One particular show that we are excited about, it's part of the Currents 36 series at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Dirk Schreiber, I hope I'm pronouncing the Germanman's name correctly there, but he's got just eye-catching work. One small picture we could focus in on in the magazine that we were told would be appearing at the Milwaukee Art Museum is a car wrecked, absolutely wrecked around a I guess it's a traffic light or light pole. But it's just amazing to think that one person could create something like this, and then also it gives you an idea, a chance to think about what this piece means on a larger sense.
Time is running a little bit low for our fall arts preview. You include a section on comedy. There's some big names in comedy coming through town. Dennis Miller, Bill Maher. You also include a section called Words, interestingly enough, that includes some book festivals and some well-known names in public radio circles like David Sedaris. But we ought to make reference briefly to the Milwaukee Film Festival, which is continuing to grow.
Exactly. And again, we tried to present the information a little bit differently. We got a behind the scenes look at the Milwaukee Film Festival. So we were able to talk to a few of the organizers with the program, and then they were able to give us some of the highlights that they're excited about, including the Earth original score. It's a movie that was released in 1930, and the local group Altos, usually a 12-member ensemble, swells to 18 members here, has penned that original score that will accompany the movie.
And as a special bonus, when you read this article, you can also find out how old all the staff members of the Milwaukee Film Festival
are. A young group of folk putting on great programming.
Well, before we go, what is the highlight, the one thing in particular that you are looking forward to this fall?
I think personally, again, this one's not written by me, but one that I'm very excited to get to is Ella Louie and All That Jazz. The Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra will be paying tribute to, obviously, Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong, if you don't know who those two names refer to. But it's just another great example of maybe not traditional classical music programming, but that might get in other people that can enjoy the wonderful talents that we have in the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra.
And that is October 11th through the 13th at the Marcus Center. The whole guide is in the magazine. Tim McCormick, thanks so much.
I thank you, Mitch.
Tim McCormick is managing editor at Milwaukee Magazine. There's a link to the magazine's Fall Arts Guide from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. That's Tuesday's edition of the program. I'm Mitch Tyke. So great to have you listening today. I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air is next.